Today's Teisho will be on case 16 in the Haikigan Roku, in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 16, Hyosei's instruction on pecking and tapping. Engo's introduction, there is no byroad to the way. There one stands absolutely firm. The Dharma transcends seeing and hearing. There one is independent of words and thoughts. If you make your way through all thorny entanglements, break down the barriers of the Buddha and the patriarchs, and attain the quiet and secret land, there heaven will find no way to send down flowers to you, and the devil no way to spy you out. All day long you act without acting, speak without speaking. Then you have learned to tap the eggshell at the moment the chick is emerging, to wield the death-dealing sword that also gives life. However, still going further, when you realize in your activity along the constructive route how to grasp the student on the one hand and release him on the other, you will deserve to be called a master. But in the realm of the absolute, things will become different. Now, how will it be with the matter of the absolute? See the following. Main subject. A monk said to Kyosei, I want to peck from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside? Kyosei said, could you attain life or not? The monk said, if I could not attain life, I would become a laughingstock. Kyosei said, you too are a fellow in the weeds. Secho's verse. Old Buddha had his way of teaching. The monks answer one no praise. Strangers to each other, hen and chick. Who can peck when the tapping comes? Outside the tap was given, inside the chick remained. Once the tap was given, monks throughout the world attempt the trick in vain. This is the final day of our spring sesshin, and once again I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job. It's really quite exciting to practice with people who are so open-hearted. It's really quite wonderful to have people come into Dokusan who have been seriously engaged with this matter. And it's very moving and wonderful. It's really thrilling, as a matter of fact. This morning, everybody did an excellent job. I was very happy with the sitting in the room. And so we have just a little time left, little precious time left. Please do your best, and we'll have opportunity to do continue Dokusan. We'll do Dokusan at 2:30, and probably what we'll do is just finish up with everybody who hasn't gone yet on the last row, and then we'll just go around the whole place one more time. Some of you are working on your mu koan, and before you leave, I'd like to have one more chance to hear your mu. Japanese tradition, and it's probably true in China too, maybe, when a monk or a nun would go to a temple and have an interview, Dokusan, with the teacher, sometimes the teacher would just say, show me your mu. And the person would call mu. Or sometimes, you could be training with a teacher and you go into the Dokusan room expecting be working on your current koan, and the teacher will say, listen, by the way, show me your mu, Yeah, so it's called checking your mu, right? It's like checking your temperature, right, but it's a standard practice, is that I wanted to check his mu, make sure it was okay, So it seems a little crazy, but the practice is about The practice of mu is about seeing if you can lose yourself in a simple act, right? Simple act of calling mu. And people do naturally lose themselves sometime. I lost myself in Dokusan just now, and we ran 15 minutes over, right? I suddenly looked at my watch and I thought, 11:15, that doesn't make any sense. What time is it anyway, you know? something doesn't make sense about that. Wait, where? What time of day is it, you know, and so on. So that's how it happened, you know. So I was in Dokusan Samadhi, right? You know, Dokusan. And I was very caught up and very engaged in what everybody was bringing into the Dokusan room. And for me, that's like heaven, right? You know, that's heaven. Because people are really trying and I'm thrilled to be practicing with people like that. So naturally, you lose track of time. And people do other kinds of things where they just lose themselves, right? Some people jog, you know, and you're running and you sort of lose yourself. But to lose yourself very, very intensely is rather rare, you know. I was reading this musician who was saying that a lot of the time playing music is just like, you know, it's just playing the notes, right, you know. He's a concert musician and he was talking about touring and, you know, he goes out on stage and does his repertoire and basically plays pretty much the same stuff every night. And you know, sometimes you're just going through the motions, right? But he said every, like, hundredth time or something, lightning strikes. And, you know, you're just inspired, right? It's just like you're swept beyond yourself and you're connected with the universe. And this is common to people who do the arts, but it's understood, I think, even more widely than that. You know, there's a famous story about a Chinese artist who had been commissioned by the emperor to do a painting of fish, right? And he was one of the most famous painters in his time, and the emperor wanted to have a high prestige painting by this guy, an ink painting. So he commissioned him to paint some fish, and of course, year one went by, no fish. You know, he made the mistake of paying him first, you know. So year one went by, no fish. Year two went by, no fish, you know. So finally, he had enough, you know. So he went in his entourage. He went to the artist's villa, and it was a beautiful Chinese villa with a courtyard and, you know, beautiful. And he went in and he, you know, roused the artist and said, "Look, you know, I paid you 3 years ago for those fish drawing, and I haven't gotten a damn thing, you know, and I want it." And so the guy went, "Okay," and he got his brush and his ink and he went. And the emperor looked at it and said, "That is fantastic," you know. And he said, "Why did you make me wait 3 years for that, you know, when you just did it in a second, right, you know?" And the guy said, the artist said, "Your Majesty, you know, come here." And he went into the artist's studio, and the guy opens a cabinet, and there's like, you know, 1,000 drawings of fish. You know, they just fall down on the floor, right, on the ground, and he opens the door. But this is a lot like Zen practice, right? It's like you call mu, and lightning strikes sometime. And so you know, I want to hear if lightning is going to strike, one time before Sesshin is over. And all you can do is spend all of your time in mushin, in ushin, in the blank, dark mind, and call mu on the cushion, and then come into the Dokusan room and lightning might strike, you know. And if it strikes, wonderful. And if it doesn't strike, also wonderful. Because either way, you know, you're becoming a very different kind of person. You're becoming a very, I would say, deeper kind of person, right? Because, you know, we modern people are used to having plans and having life deliver on our plans, and when it doesn't deliver, we feel despondent, angry, fearful, bitter, we feel self-loathing, whatever, you know. But, you know, a person of Zen, a man of Zen or a woman of Zen, has a different relationship to the universe, different relationship to reality. You know, we know lightning doesn't always strike, and yet it doesn't undermine our confidence in the universe. See, this is tremendously important. Right? I think this is just tremendously important. You know, I've mentioned this before, but I remember one sesshin, we were all sitting very hard, and pretty much everybody was going into the Dokusan room and striking out. You know, you could sort of feel the frustration, because and I myself was working on this koan, and I just thought I had a breakthrough. You know, I can't remember what the koan was, but it was raining outside. It's Seattle, so it's always raining outside. But I suddenly became aware of the rain. And I think I might have been working on the koan, What Does Buddha Ride? But I didn't answer it at that sesshin. But I was sitting on the cushion, and I was listening to the rain, and I thought, my God, you know, I feel like I'm watching the rain, I'm hearing the rain with my eyes, and I feel like I'm hearing the rain with my eyes. And it was just like, just so obviously so, you know. And anyway, I went into Genki Roshi, and he said, well, you know, that's nice, but that's not the answer. Ding! So out you go. And, so I'm back on my cushion thinking, oh, man, you know, this is so unfair. And I put in so much energy into this koan, you know, and then Genki Roshi came out, and he actually, maybe because people were frustrated, he said, listen, if you learn nothing else from Zen practice, you'll learn patience. Right? And people burst into laughter. We thought he was making a joke, you know. But it was so important. It was so important to understand this, that you know, we Zen people, we Zen men and women, don't live that way, you know. Just because lightning doesn't strike doesn't mean the universe has let us down. We have a deeper relationship with the universe, see. It's very important. You know, there was a teacher who was quite successful teacher. His name was Maizumi Roshi. And Maizumi had started the Los Angeles Zen Center. And like any big, this happened in the 60s, basically, when Zen was quite, on the West Coast, Zen was very hot, you know. And he had lots of students. At that time, there weren't that many Zen centers in Los Angeles. He was a really highly qualified Japanese Roshi. And he came from a small temple in Japan and started this center. He originally just came for the Japanese community in LA, but so many Americans were interested in practicing Zen, he began to have a little sitting group, and then that became very large, and that became his primary concern. But the atmosphere was very American in one sense. You know, people got very competitive about their koan practice, right? So people would, you know, would do what you're not supposed to do, which is to talk about their koans and their answers and so on. And they'd be competitive, like, well, did you answer your koan? No. Well, I answered two, you know, this kind of thing. And people, you know, had like a timetable, like this is a, you know, and so very, that's a very unhealthy and counterproductive attitude. You know, it's extremely counterproductive, because it doesn't matter if you answer a koan every sesshin if you're not any farther to change, you know. If you're still fearful, unhappy, etc., answering koans in and of themselves, you know, doesn't really get necessarily, believe it or not, closer to enlightenment. You know, it's possible to answer a koan, and answer another koan, and answer another koan, and that creates a dilemma for a teacher, because the teacher says, well, you know, I'm waiting for you to have a great awakening experience, and you're answering koans, but where's the great awakening experience? You know, so you can try to, you know, throw the students a harder and harder koans. What you really want is something that's going to arrest the student, you know, that's going to stop the student dead in his tracks or dead in her tracks, and allow that person to have a different relationship to the universe, see? And what you want is a koan that's so tough, right, that the person fails at some point. And then, basically, you know, has to enter a different relationship to the universe, where you know, lightning didn't strike, and then I say, well, this is no good, this is crap, you know, I hate this Zen, you know, or you say, I'm no good, I'm a bum, I knew I'd never amount to anything, you know. But those are all familiar responses. But at some point, you know, you have an attitude towards the universe where basically you are still one with the universe, even when you don't answer your koan, even when lightning doesn't strike, you know, and that feeling of connectedness, of love and gratitude. Is really what everything is all about. You know, it's what Zen is all about. So, you know, if you are calling Mu, and you go into the Dokusan room, and you're waiting for this thunderous Mu, and this little Mu comes out. You know, one time I was calling Mu, and I was calling so hard I hurt my vocal cords. Really? No, really. I have a high squeaky voice now, but I used to sound I used to sound like, I don't know, Brad Pitt one time. Not really. But, or Jeremy Irons or somebody like that. I used to have a British accent. My vocal cords. But I really did hurt my vocal cords, and I was so determined to answer this koan, and I went in to the Roshi, and I just went moo. I started oh, and it was like slipping on ice, right? My voice just gave out, you know. It was like I started halfway up the slope of moo, and my voice just gave out. It was like. Really, it was just like a, you know, gasping, right? And then I couldn't say anything because I had wrecked my vocal cords. It was like croaking, right? You know, this really happened. I swear, this really happened. And so, you know, then you can go back to your cushion and say, now I'm really screwed. I'll never answer this koan because how can I call you when my vocal cord? You know? Somebody once asked me, why do you do all this bowing? You know, why do you bow to the cushions all the time? What is that all about? And that's an excellent question. Why do you bow all the time? See, sometimes it's just an empty gesture. Just empty gesture. But, you know, sometimes it really is, you really mean it, you know? So, I love sesshin. I wish this, I'm on the day five of a 5-day sesshin, I'm always slightly bummed out because I just wish we could go on, you know. We can have another good dinner, you know, we can sit tonight, it would be great, you know, and just go on, it would just be wonderful. So, you know, at any rate, I'm a little bit bummed out, but my basic feeling is about sesshin is that it's the most precious thing in the world, right? It's like, I am so grateful that sesshin exists because it has saved my life. You know, it has made my life so wonderful. And I have been coming to sesshin for 30 years with all kinds of problems, and if you practice wholeheartedly, you know, you can be liberated. And you sit on the cushion and you're working with your koan, and whether or not you answer your koan, you know, you can still end up at the end of the sesshin with your hands together in your heart, right, saying, I am so grateful for my life. You know, I'm so grateful to be alive, you know. And this is a deep practice. This is what it means to be a woman of Zen or a man of Zen. It's not about answering koans. They're just a means to an end. It's about having a grateful heart. And a grateful heart is a heart that's connected with everything that's alive, right? So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're not answering your koan, but suddenly you hear the wind and you think, oh, how beautiful. Or you go in and you have some rice and you think, this is heaven itself. Or you have some tea and you think, this is so delicious. I'm so glad to be here at this moment. You know, this is the essence of Zen. This is Buddha itself. This is enlightenment itself. And so it's like you're in your heart, you put your hands together, you say, I am so glad for this life. I am so glad for just this moment. Thank you. And of course, that's very difficult for humans to say in the presence of a failure, right? I have a plan, and my plan is X, and then I do my level best, and I go for it, and I don't succeed. And at that moment, you know, you can go to heaven or you can go to hell, right? You know, and most of us go to hell over and over and over again, right? This is what koan training is all about, you know. You go into the teacher and the teacher says, nope. And you say, but I sat, you know, God damn you, you know, I sat all those extra hours. You know, you owe it to me, you know. And I felt that way myself. Sometimes I was just hopping mad, you know. I was working on a koan once, and I was so mad. I can remember coming back into the Zendo. This was when we built our temple up in the mountains. I was sitting there, and I was just thinking, this is a bunch of shit, you know. This is a fraud. This Zen is a fraud. I'm going to tell everybody it's a fraud, you know. Really. I mean, I would just say, that's my last session. I'm out of here, you know. And, you know, you go through, then, you know, you go home and you think, well, you know, I kind of, something about this I can't really live without, you know. And then you go back to the next session and, you know, you just, after a while, you go to hell enough time, you know. And that's you go through enough lifetimes in hell, and then you just, you know, you begin to soften up a little bit, and you begin to say, well, you know, it's not so bad to be in hell. It's not so bad. It's not so bad in hell. I'm in hell, and yet I thank the universe for my life, for this moment. In hell. No, no, this is very important. This is what it's all about. I'm in hell, but I thank the universe for this. My heart is breaking with love for this universe, even though my legs hurt and I've not done anything I set out to do with my life. And, you know, I haven't answered my damn koan, you know. And yet, you know, my heart is breaking and it's full of love for this world, right? This is what we have to learn, you know. This is Zen practice. This is Zen practice, you know. It's not about success or failure. It's not about answering the koan or failing to answer the koan. It's about being able, as long as we say to the universe, this is not acceptable. You know, this is not acceptable. This is not an acceptable state. We're far from awake, right? And most people are saying it all the time. And we're constantly grasping after a phantom of, so many of us, one way to put it is like this, you know. When you get into Zen or into meditation practice, one of the things that might do it for you is the smiling picture of the Dalai Lama, you know. Because, you know, you pick up a magazine, here's the Dalai Lama at some stadium in some town, you know, he's packed in 40,000 people, and he goes out and he goes, hey, you know, hello, hello, and he's always laughing, you know, he seems so happy, you know, and the happy smile of the teacher is very contagious, right, because we say, I want to be happy too, you know. And yet, you know, if I may say so, it's actually like a fatal strategy. Even though people get enticed into all of this stuff because they want to be happy, actually trying to be happy is a fatal strategy. It never works. It never works, right? Our whole world is restlessly tearing itself apart in a feverish effort to be happy, you know. So basically, you know, people go to, you know, everybody does this. I mean, my sister and her husband have a perfectly good house, right? It's perfect. Anybody who looked at it would say, boy, you should be lucky you're in this house. And yet it's not the house in the magazine, you know. So they're going to go into debt, and they're going to build this palace, basically, you know. Fortunately, my sister will never listen to this. You know, they're going to build this palace, right? And they're going to get the palace built, they're going to move in, and nothing is going to be different, right? And when that happens, when people suddenly realize, oh my God, you know, we went through all this and nothing, they can get very dejected. Very down, very depressed, you know. You know, who would guess that you're more likely to be happy by, taking things away than adding things, right? I actually think I'm a much happier person than my sister. But I actually haven't really tried to be happy, you know, actually. I got into Zen because I was so unhappy that I just wanted to get out of hell, right? And then, of course, I spent a long time in hell over and over again, you know, in the hell that I had made at Sashin, you know. And at some point, you just say, geez, for some strange reason, I'm not miserable right now. And I ought to be, you know, because I haven't answered my koan. I haven't done anything I set out to do. You know, for all intents and purposes, I should be really unhappy, but I'm strangely happy, you know. And that's deliverance, right? That's wonderful. That's heaven itself. I have lost, but I'm strangely happy, you know. And that's the life of the Zen man or woman, is to be strangely happy with nothing, You know? And so you can't, if you try to be happy, you're never going to succeed. And that's the road to hell, in my opinion. But if you give up on the aspiration to be happy, and you just practice mushin, you just have empty mind, and you walk the road of mushin, one day you just wake up and you say, geez, you know, on one level I'm unhappy, but on another level I'm just really happy, I'm really grateful. You know, there's a Tibetan guy whose name escapes me right now who wrote a book called How to Be Happy When You're Not. I just love, that's it. That's it, right? How to be happy when you're not. Perfect. I am so grateful for my life at this moment. I have not answered my koan, but isn't that wonderful? See, isn't that wonderful? See, that's it, when you can say that, you're free, right? You're free. Say, I applied for medical school and I got rejected, right? Say, I'm so grateful for my life. I'm so grateful for this precious life. You know? Then you're free. That is awakening. That is awakened mind. Zen practice is a little bit like, if you're in hell, how do you get out of hell, right? I guess I could put it that way. It's a little bit like a chick in an egg, right? I mean, you can't make anything happen. You can't make it happen. That's like trying to be happy. It's doomed, right? So you're like a little chick in an egg, and you don't know what's on the other side of the egg. You don't even know you're in an egg, right? You're uncertain, and you're pecking at the shell, you know? Pecking to get out. Peck, 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 peck. And the hen is like a little, you know, this actually happens. The chicks... I was reading this article that I couldn't quite believe, but it said that something like 30% of the school children in Great Britain didn't know where eggs came from. Really? Really? My brother, if he were still alive, he would say, well, that's what socialism did to them. Really, that's what he'd say. And I am a socialist, so, and I know where eggs come from. So, you know, eggs, a chick is in an egg, right? And the chick tries to get out of the egg and has to peck its way out, but it doesn't know what's on the other side of the egg. And it doesn't know that mom is on the other side of the egg shell, right? You know? It just knows, oh my God, I've got to get out of here. And it doesn't know what to do, so it's just sort of pecking, and it doesn't quite have the strength, right? I'm sure somebody won't mind saying this, mind my saying this, but somebody who had a good answer for a koan didn't notice that that was the answer. The person was looking for another answer, a better one. And was expecting like this great Kensho experience, which is so typical, right? I mean, everybody does this. We're waiting to have like the earthquake experience, right? Where the room shook and, you know, everything lit up, and the next thing I knew I saw Buddha, and, you know, we all want that, right? But in fact, this person had answered the koan and said, I guess I backed into the answer. But that's always how it is, see? You always back into happiness. You back into the answer. Because it's always what you didn't expect, right? So it's always like that. You're always blindly groping. You know, that's one of the things that people don't understand. You think, well, I've answered three koans. I ought to be getting better at this, but every time it's just I'm back in the, you know, same old place, you know, sitting there in darkness with no, you know, of course. You have to back in. So you're like a little chick and you're pecking at the shell and you don't know what the heck is going on, right? And you can have all kinds of self-doubts about this process, right? It's possible to be, you know, the poor little chick thinks, where am I? You know, this is, you know, this can't be the whole thing. This can't be the world, right? I can barely move, you know? And I just gotta get out of here. I'm claustrophobic, you know, whatever. And then the shell, it's so hard, you know, and my beak is so small, you know? And I begin to have doubts, you know, about things, right? What it doesn't know is like the big hen, you know, is trying to get through at the other side, right? And so, you know, the universe is really trying to help us wake up. It sounds utterly impossible, right? But another way to put it is your big mind is really trying to help you wake up, you know. And we have all these doubts and all these fears, but it's like the hen, right? It's coming at it from the other side, and all we can do is just all we have to do is knock at the door. You know, you just have to peck at the shell, and mom is going to come and peck a big hole right through that shell, right? You know, you can't do it, but your big mind, your mother hen mind, can do it. Right? And so you just have to knock. So a lot of Zen practice is just calling, watching the breath, watching the breath, watching the breath, or calling mu, calling mu, calling mu. And you can sit there and think, oh my God, I'll never do this. This is impossible, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it is indeed impossible for your small self. But, you know, help is on the way, right? Help is really and truly on the way. You have a deeper mind, a bigger power that is, even as we speak, helping you. So this is really a very important thing to remember as you practice. Now, you know, basically, I was debating this morning about which koan to do, because I wanted to do this one about the chick and the hen, because I thought so many of you are tapping at the shell, and I wanted you to know that that's exactly right. That's all you can do. You can just tap at the shell and tap at the shell, and your big mind is going to take care of everything. And you just have to have patience, right? You have to forgive the universe for not delivering what you want. And you have to forgive yourself, right? And when you do that, you suddenly find that everything is heaven, right? So some psychological transformation has to happen. And when it does, you have your hands together in your heart, okay? But that was the one koan that I wanted to talk about. So this is like two for the price of one. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's case 10. The other one I was debating was this one. It goes, Bokushu asked a monk, where are you from? The monk gave a katz shout, which is like a Zen shout. You know, Zen people don't go, huh, or hi, or hey. They go, katz! I don't know why, but that's the Zen shout. So, and Bokushu said, this old monk is shouted down by you. The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, what about the third and the fourth shouts? The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, you empty-headed fool. See? So this is like Dharma competition, right? Bokushu asked the monk, where are you from? So that's a Zen question. It's saying, show me your state of enlightenment or your state of mind. And the monk gave a shout. Hats! Bokushu said, he said, that's not much. You don't have much to show me. The monk shouted again, Katz! And Bokushu said, well, that's, can you show me the third and the fourth one? Maybe they're better. This time the monk stayed silent. And Bokushu hit the monk and said, you empty-headed fool. So that looks like contempt, right? Looks like you don't know anything. But see, that's a high compliment. You know, if you want to practice Zen, if you want to practice Zen, you know, what you want to achieve is this thoughtless state of empty mind, right? You want to be an empty-headed fool. You know, if anybody calls you an empty-headed fool, say, gee, thanks, you know? But it has to be real, right? It has to be real. People think that being empty-headed is stupid, but not at all. People are made stupid by their ideas. They're made stupid by their dreams and their feverish quest for happiness, right? When we become an empty-headed fool, this moment becomes beautiful, becomes heaven itself, right? You know, we sit in the moment and think, this is not the moment I want. You know, I could be doing this. You know, I could be doing that. And some of us are halfway in this moment and halfway in some other moment, right, that we imagine. But the truth is that if you have no thought, if you're just an empty-headed fool, and you're sitting there on the cushion and your mind is blank, and your mind is blank, and your mind is blank, you know, sooner or later, you know, the universe is changed. You know, the universe is a wonderful place to be if we aren't held in prison by our ideas and our dreams and our thoughts. Bokushu's empty-headed fool, and that's a real compliment. Bokushu is paying that guy a real compliment. And if you want to be a good chick, you know, just be an empty-headed fool chick, right? Just peck. Peck, peck, peck. Peck, peck, peck. And don't worry about anything. Don't worry about whether you're, you know, what kind of a bird am I? You know, will I ever get out of this shell? And sooner or later, you know, the little chicken goes through all of has all these self-doubts and loathing and, you know, unhappiness. And at some point, you know, doesn't worry. You know, just, I may not get out of here and I may get out of here. You know, and what do you know? You know, life is going to begin. That little chick. So we're going to have one more dokusan, and come into the room with an empty mind. If your koan is moved, just open your mouth, and whatever comes out is what's going to happen today, right? And it's just wonderful. Whatever happens is just wonderful. Okay. And remember that you know, failure, so-called, is there's no advantage to success in any way. People think there is, but there's not. There's no advantage to success, you know. Actually, success or failure are probably 50-50, right? In fact, maybe failure is better, because then people are stymied and they have to develop a deeper character, deeper life. Yeah. It's easy for me to say, right? Like everybody else, I want to be successful in the enterprises I have set for myself. And I too hurt when things don't go my way, right? That hurts. And I cry and I curse. But sit on the cushion and empty-headed fool, and then I feel a little better. And then my heart is full of love, and I think, well, you know, this is a big world, and my life is very precious. It's short, and, you know, I'm very small in an infinite universe, but I'm part of the whole thing, and I'm so grateful, and I love it all, yeah. And that's heaven itself. A monk said to Kyosei, I want to peck from the inside, would you please tap from the outside? Kyosei said, could you attain life or not? The monk said, if I could not attain life, I would become a laughingstock. Kyose said, you too are a fellow in the weeds. In other words, you're really confused still. But that's a compliment too, right? If I could not attain life, he said. See, basically the person says, could you attain life or not? You know, we're all striving to attain life, right? I really haven't, you know, some people actually think this way. Here I am, I'm 60 years old and I have never lived. You know, it's like, please, that's pure fantasy. Right? Never lived, of course. You know, this moment is, you don't have to go to, there's that book, like 1,000 places to see before you die, right? You know, I just think that's like, that should be called Eat Your Heart Out, you know, because, right? It's like your book of unhappiness, right? It's so modern, it's so American, it's so, you know, it's like, so he better start getting cracking and going to all those places. And then you think, oh my God, we don't have enough money to go to Kathmandu, you know, and yet it's on the list, it's number 6, you know. And, oh, we're really not living life, are we? You know? Okay. And so then, you know, you come here, you get up at 4:30, it's cold, you know, eat rice every day, you know, have some vegetables, you know. Same thing, day in and day out. You say, I've never really lived, you know, but actually, you know, when you live this way, I think things become unspeakably precious and beautiful. Don't they?